Hi, this is Ken McCarthy, and I'm going to be talking with Sam Pratt. Sam was one of the founders of an organization called Friends of Hudson, and we're going to talk about their success in very difficult circumstances. And perhaps one of the biggest grassroots success stories of the last several years. Certainly people in our area, the Hudson Valley, are aware of it, but people in other parts of the country and the world may not have ever heard of it, and there are a lot of lessons that can be taken from this particular story. It's a classic David and Goliath type of story, and I guess I'll start telling the story right now. It all centers around a small city in the Hudson Valley called Hudson, New York. And Hudson has about how many people, Sam?
About 8,000 people at the time this started. It's a little less now.
Okay, and it's the capital of a pretty rural county.
Yep,
and
it's a small city surrounded by farms, basically.
Okay, and it's right on the Hudson River. It has a fascinating history, which I encourage people to look into, but we won't go into it in this call. But it's a city that has a lot of economic challenges, and what happened is the second largest, or a company that was part of the second largest cement manufacturing company in the world, saw Hudson and said, this would be a great place to put our huge cement factory. And the problem with that is twofold. One, cement making is a fairly dirty business because of the materials that are handled. But second, the fuels that are used to heat and fuel cement manufacturing are often dirty, sometimes literally dirty, old automotive tires, medical waste. I mean, these things are actually used as fuel for the kilns.
Yeah, a cement engineer once said to me, well, if it burns, it has fuel value, and we'll throw it in the kiln with the coal and the rest of it.
And then, of course, all this goes up into the air and comes out in a highly pulverized form and ends up in people's lungs. And we're talking about things like mercury and lead and arsenic. And so in the best of worlds, these plants are located far away from human habitations, not adjacent to a populated city with schools and hospitals and retirement homes. And they're also, in the best of all possible worlds, they're built to the state of the art, using the best possible fuel, natural gas versus coal, using filtering methods so that the garbage isn't put into the air. But the company in question, St. Lawrence Cement, really wasn't interested in any of those things. They wanted to keep all options open. They wanted the right to burn medical waste. They wanted the right to burn tires. They wanted to did they want to run the plant 24 hours a day, 7 days a week?
Oh, absolutely. You can't really shut down a cement plant. Once it starts up, they want it to stay on continuously for its entire life.
And this would have been devastating, not only to the city of Hudson, but to the region, and it would have set a horrible precedent because it's cement making is heavy industry, and the Hudson Valley largely, not entirely, but largely is free of heavy industry, and to bring something of this scale. And this was going to be one of the largest coal-powered cement plants in the continent?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. At the time, the company was the largest cement company in the world, and they were proposing a plant that was about three and a half times larger than anything we've seen in our region before. The footprint of the plant would have actually taken up more acreage by about 50% than our entire city. It would have sort of straddled both our waterfront and about an 1,800-acre parcel in the neighboring town. So this was a truly massive, completely game-changing proposal for the region, which is, a major breadbasket for the Northeast. We do have an enormous amount of food production as well as obviously people here that would have been downwind from this plant's emissions.
And it's an area that is undergoing a revival on many levels. I think an agricultural revival, more small farms are starting to, there are a lot of small farms already and family-owned farms, and people are experimenting with, you know, organic means of production and smaller scale farming, and, you know, it's an area that has a lot of interesting things going on.
Absolutely, and you know, the other thing that was important to our case was to argue the economics of it as well as the environmental side. A lot of us are motivated by just the sheer scale and the toxic nature of the proposal, but the more we got into it, we realized that they also weren't going to help our economy because they're basically transferring workers that are already in this huge multinational corporation to our area, so there would have only been one new net job, even though they're creating this massive new facility. And
so
that's the piece of advice we always, you know, pass on to others is, you know, there's usually is almost as strong an economic argument as an environmental argument against, you know, these kind of blighting projects.
Excellent. Yeah, and so that's one of the several things to get in line as soon as possible is what is this really going to cost the region? Of course, the cement plant and the cement company just talked about the benefits, the so-called economic benefits, but in reality,
right,
in terms of job creation, it was as close to zero as you can get without being zero.
Exactly.
And it was going to have, I think the case could be made, I think you guys may have made the case, that it was going to have tremendous negative benefits. For instance, a big part of the economy around Hudson are people who are, they specifically left the city to find a nicer place to live, and they brought their businesses with them and their professions. Real estate was important, still important up there, and all the things surrounding real estate, construction, insurance, and so on. And if they were to put this plant in, it would have completely changed the character of the area. And I mean, nobody in their right mind would have wanted to go to the Hudson area if this plant were in place to live a quiet, peaceful, pleasant existence.
Yeah, you know, we were really arguing that, you know, we're trying to build an economy in our area which built on the strengths of the region, which included, you know, the beautiful scenery, the rich agricultural land, as well as the Main Street business experience that, you know, has disappeared in a lot of the country, but we still retain. So we ended up having everybody from farmers to small business owners on Main Street to even other small manufacturers in the area saying, look, you know, this company claims they're going to be bringing in, you know, all this economic development to our area, but what they're really going to do is basically chase out all the existing business and make this an undesirable place for, you know, more compatible businesses to move. And it took us a long time to assemble that argument, and in particular a long time to embolden, you know, business leaders and small business people as well to speak out. But once we got enough momentum, it was amazing how many people, you know, who initially said, oh, I can't say anything because, you know, of whatever political or personal concern they might have, who eventually, you know, felt, you know, okay, there's enough horsepower behind these folks that now I can jump on the bandwagon. And they became instrumental in convincing some of the elected officials in our state and even on the federal level that, you know, hey, this isn't just, you know, big business versus a bunch of like radical environmentalists. This is a very mainstream movement.
Well, let's talk about the outcome and then how you got to that outcome.
Sure.
So just to set the stage, when this proposal was first put out there, it received pretty much universal enthusiastic support from the entire political structure of the city, if I remember correctly.
Well, it was really worse than that. We had the company lobbied extensively on both the local, the county, and the state and federal levels before any of us even knew they were coming. So they had basically the politicians all lined up in advance. They very quickly, had most of our local press, which was fairly hostile to citizen interest to begin with, in their pocket. And then they launched an absolutely massive PR campaign, which involved direct mailings throughout the region to every household, which involved extensive radio and TV ad blitzes, you name it. They tried to basically swamp us in the first 6 months, which is, I think, a common strategy, you know, so that any opposition really couldn't get its feet out from under it, and it just, it felt like a done deal to people. So even though those who were opposed sort of said, well, this is a terrible thing, but we don't have any chance of winning, so I'm not going to get involved. And even some of the more progressive environmental organizations in our area basically sent us that message when we put in the early distress calls, and saying, oh, geez, yeah, that's a terrible idea, but they've got too much juice in the capital and with the local politicians, so we're not going to help you fight it. But we kind of bulldozed through that early, very depressing period, and eventually were able to overcome all of those obstacles.
So if we put this in military terms, it was an ambush. In other words,
yeah.
they were setting up their attack quietly, and next thing you knew, you were surrounded.
Right.
And they had tied up all the politicians and all the local media. And then, to continue the military analogy, then they carpet bombed you.
Yeah.
With all the media, trying to get the media momentum going. And this had a really, initially successful psychological impact on the whole community. Everyone considered, I remember remembering back to when this all got started, it was considered a done deal, and
absolutely
impossible to change.
Yeah, it really was. I mean, I hate to even invoke the phrase, but it really was kind of a shock and awe strategy that they employed. But like the folks, in the Pentagon who kind of miscalculated there, as far as, you know, what the effect of a massive saturation bombing campaign would have, they underestimated the fact that when you've got people on the ground, whose lives and homes and businesses are at stake, you know, the people on the ground have a lot more power than they realize, because you're fighting on your own turf. And we kind of always hearken back to George Washington and the American Revolution. You know, Washington didn't win actually a lot of battles, but he knew that he was fighting an adversary from overseas, who was at a great distance, who seemed, almost invincible. But he was, King George was back in London, and the Patriots were here fighting on their own turf. And the company we were up against was based in Switzerland, at the time the largest cement company in the world, actually. And what the flip side of their massive initial campaign was that it gave them a lot of overconfidence. They kind of thought, okay, we've done our job, and these loony leftists, don't stand a chance. And then they kind of sat back, and we took the approach of, this is going to be a long battle. We've got to move quickly, but, we tried to really take incremental steps day by day, small gains that added up over time. And so we then began to creep up on them. They'd ambushed us. But then we did a very slow ambush on the company, and eventually we were able to strike back without them, really knowing what had hit them either.
And when you say it was a long battle, this went on, I forget the exact number of years, but
almost 7 years, about 6.5 years. They announced the project in September of 1998, and we won finally in April of 2005. But I should probably be more specific about, some of the tactics that we used. And the number one tactic is the simplest thing in the world, was basically talking to neighbors. When I and some of my early cohorts got going, our number one rule was, no meeting was too small. If we met somebody who was interested, who wanted to help or wanted to hear more, we'd say, great, could you have, you know, even your two best friends or your families or your neighbors over to your house. You know, we don't need anything. If you want to, you know, put out some coffee and donuts, that's great. But, you know, it was a real low-tech operation. We didn't have a lot of money, but we had, you know, some time we could put into spreading the word. And really, it wasn't even early on. We didn't even necessarily have a complete mastery of the issue. We were going out and talking to people as much to find out, what do we need to know? Who do we need to talk to? You know, we were trying to understand both a very complex regulatory process, which involved a dozen different agencies issuing 17 different permits to this project, and also a local, county, state, and even federal political strategy that we eventually developed. But it was that, you know, taking the time and being willing to put ourselves out in the public to slowly build a network of people was the essential part. I mean, we were obviously spending a lot of time in front of our computers. Luckily, the Internet was just taking off, and we had that amazing research tool at our disposal. But, you know, it was very important for us to not just sit online and research the company's track record, which we used to great effect to research the technology involved in the environmental and other issues we were dealing with, but it was that face-to-face human component, which was so essential. You know, for so many reasons, because when you're out there among people, you know, it's amazing the talents you uncover. You know, you're not just looking for another person to write a letter to the editor or sign a petition, which is extremely important, but, you know, to keep our eyes open for people who had specific skills. And when we met you, Ken, and you gave us amazing advice on direct marketing early on that was, you know, we had no expertise there, which we used and put to good use immediately. Other people who had, you know, particular expertise on environmental toxins or on, financial analysis. Another guy got really involved in the history of the area and started looking into the land titles surrounding the project that we were dealing with. And so people really come out of the woodwork, but you got to be out there for those happy accidents and those discoveries to happen.
Well, I remember, even late in the game, that you were always willing, and your cohorts were always willing to meet with anybody, anytime, anywhere, practically. Who had an interest in this?
It really has a snowball effect. I mean, not to belabor the point, but you know, a lot of what happened was we would get to these big decision-making points in the process where you needed to turn out 100 people or 1,000 people even for an event, you know, to speak out and to really, you know, convince politicians and regulators to do the right thing. But because we've been beating the bushes for so long and been talking face-to-face with people and strengthening our arguments and being challenged by our friends and neighbors to really, you know, get all of our facts straight and developing new arguments and new lines of attack, by the time those crucial events came along, you know, we had the whole army assembled because people had been talking and thinking and strategizing and writing and researching on their own for a long time, and all we had to do then was make sure that they knew when and where to show up, and, you know, we didn't have to script statements like the company did for their supporters. We didn't have to, you know, pay people to come to meetings. We didn't have to offer them free T-shirts and lunch and all the things that, you know, kind of astroturf movements do. You know, we had that army. So I don't want to belabor it, but I can't stress enough that face-to-face personal interaction.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that army, because I think that, I mean, that clearly is what made the difference. Initially, how many people would you say were at the sort of the core of the group, you know, the people that actually made it a full or close to full-time occupation?
Well, it really began with just a handful of people who were, you know, meeting in my living room and exchanging emails. But eventually we grew into, we had a board of 15 people. We had a real skeleton staff of three full-time people and a couple of part-timers and then a ton of volunteers. One really essential, leap forward for us was when we did finally get the organization out of off my dining room table and into a small storefront. Initially the space was donated and then we moved up and were able to pay a little bit of rent. But, kind of professionalizing the operation. I'm a former journalism. I love to be in front of the computer and writing and thinking and researching. But, to have an active place where people can stop in, where if you need help with a mailing just to get labels on, or if you need to start setting up committees, to have a physical location to do that was great. But, there was kind of, at any given time, there was a core group, I would say, of, 100 to 150 people who were really intensely involved in one way or another.
Okay.
In terms of people who were, full-time devoted to it, it was just, less than a half dozen. And then we ended up, we went from 40 initial members to 4,000 paid members who really sustained the fight. I mean, we eventually did get some grant funding, but most of our support was small grassroots contributions of $20, $25, with thousands of people giving over and over again over a long period of time.
So when you started, it was a half dozen or less people.
Yeah.
And then you had people who were interested, but in terms of people actually doing stuff, it was a handful.
Yeah.
And very early on, and this was something that we talked about pretty early on, was the need to build a membership organization, to focus on that, and to focus on growing the numbers of it.
Yeah.
I think we talked about the importance of it being paid membership,
mm-hmm.
Welcoming everybody, but there's a certain commitment that people have above and beyond the value of the money and the fact that you can use the money for things. There's a certain level of commitment that somebody has when they put money into it.
Absolutely. It helps keep people interested and involved when they have an investment, whether it's of money or of volunteer time. I'd say I've talked a lot about, being out there in the public. The other end of that is having a really strong, back end. It doesn't need to be much more than a database in your office, but it can be an old-fashioned filing card system, or it can be a robust online database. But not letting people get lost. Someone signs a petition. I think we got about 16,000 people on our petition by the end in a very sparsely populated rural area. But, we kept track of everybody who came into the loop, pro and con, public officials, supporters, potential supporters, voters, property owners, and developed a very large database and, kept in constant contact with those people. People sometimes say to me, Sam, why do you send an email and a postcard, and a fax, and have somebody call us before a big meeting? And, the answer was that, for every one person who was annoyed by being repeatedly contacted, there was 99 who were grateful. And the turnout at our events, whether it was fundraisers or rallies or public hearings, was phenomenal because we had built this whole engine to stay in touch with people. And, of course, now with the Internet and social networking and email and, listservs and the rest of it, there's so much more that can be done. But it was really crucial not just to say, have a little meeting with someone, have them sign a petition and say thanks for your support. It was then going back to them and saying, well, how else would you like to help? Or giving them a list of 10 things they can do besides just putting their signature on something. And giving people really specific tools for for moving the issue forward.
Gotcha, gotcha. So reaching out to people, inviting them to join your effort in one way or another, and then once they've said yes to something, they're in the loop now, and you continuously were communicating with them.
Yeah.
And there was a, I think there's also a great deal of ongoing, never ending education. So so if someone was a member, you'd learn about every breakthrough. You'd learn about every new discovery. You'd learn about every new, even the setbacks.
Yeah.
You'd learn about every new need as they arise. And this is really, you refer to this, but let's really talk about this because I think it's very important. I think one of the things that might have surprised you when we first talked was I said, the more the better, you know.
Right.
Tell the whole story. And a lot of people are concerned, oh, well, people don't have time, or they're not going to be interested, or it will be too much. And the point is, if somebody's already raised their hand and shown they're interested, pour it on.
Yeah.
If they're not interested, they'll just tune out, which they've already tuned out anyway. If they are interested, the additional information, the detail, the ongoing communication builds their commitment and their understanding, because a lot of this is an educational process.
It is also crucial to sustaining interest over time. I mean, you get a lot of fatigue in these situations. The battle goes on for 5, 6, you know, I've seen ones that go on for 10 or 15 years. And, you know, a lot of it is keeping up the interest of those who, you know, have been at it for 3 or 4 years. So to be constantly feeding them with some new information, you know, some new outrage that you've discovered, or, you know, a new study that sheds light on the issue, you know, to keep your issue at the center of the conversation in a community or a region or even a nation is, you know, requires that constant attention. The other thing that we came to realize was that, you know, those of us who were intensely involved took a lot of the basic information for granted.
Mm-hmm.
You know, after the 100th time we'd explained, you know, that there was only one new job, or that cement plants emit mercury, arsenic, lead, you know, and other toxins. You know, these things were like the gospel to us, and we didn't need to repeat them. But, you know, not everybody's paying as close attention as the principal figures are. Some people are coming into the issue late. Some people only read, you know, some of the stuff that comes across their desk. So it was important to kind of to reiterate the basics along with the news constantly, so that, you know, everybody was up to speed. And, you know, again, for us, it seems like, you know, oh, we don't need to say this again. Everybody knows that. But in fact, not everybody knows what, you know, the principles, the principal actors in the drama, you know, take for granted. So, and you were absolutely right in your advice in terms of, you know, it's not that you want to throw absolutely everything at people, but people, if they're interested, they really want to understand. They want to master the issue and make it their own, and then maybe add something of their own to it. I mean, we had a member, a woman, who went out and wrote an entire manual on the issue and got a grant to publish a very handsome guidebook to the entire issue, which ran to about 120 pages, and I think she got rid of about 12,000 copies of that. And you think, who on earth wants to read an entire book about the driest subject on earth, you know, cement manufacturing? But when people, you know, get engaged, they want to be smart on the issue. They don't want to get caught, you know, without an answer if they're debating it with somebody else. And they want to be empowered by that information. Distilling it into a form, you know, we had everything from, you know, postcard size summaries to book length summaries of the issue, and you tailored that to different audiences. But generally, yeah, I was absolutely amazed at how much people were able and interested in absorbing, and how that kept the conversation going.
And I think it's very important that you didn't rely just on the internet. You had physical mailings and
right.
Brochures and point speaking point sheets, and it was a vast variety of media came out of this.
Yeah, because everybody pays attention to different things, or you just happen to catch somebody, with the postcard who ignored the email or missed the email. People are busy. They've got their families to take care of. They've got their jobs to go to and the rest of it. So, it was a matter of getting enough out there that eventually you got everybody. It was working the media, but also going around the media. It was really crucial to us to, have mechanisms for getting our side of the story out, even when the press wasn't cooperating.
And the press was, I think it's very important for you to realize, the press was not only not cooperative, but was often downright hostile and even inaccurate.
slanderous. I mean, we got called every name under the sun. What was interesting, though, was, we kind of use a carrot and stick approach with the media. We were unsparing when they got things wrong or they were being, blatantly unfair. We did not hesitate to criticize them and call them out on their mistakes. But we also really, at the same time, we tried to really cultivate reporters, who some of whom were initially very unfriendly to us. But, by working with them, by not giving up on them, by, leaking stories to them first occasionally and selectively so that they felt like they could get some exclusive information, I mean, we became a pretty interesting story to cover. It was, it was a lot better than going to the, the planning board meeting, for routine zoning changes. The kind of stories that typically appear in our local papers, which are pretty drab. We made this a big, exciting, dramatic controversy because we genuinely felt it was a life and death struggle for the future of the community. But people sometimes advise, you shouldn't be too hard on the press because, they've got all these barrels of ink that they can turn against you. But I tend to find that, unless you really stand your ground to a certain extent, you don't get much respect from them. And we were amazed at some of the reporters who initially really were doing us a lot of dirt who became interested and kind of quietly started to come around to seeing that we knew what we were talking about and maybe we were even right.
Well, you stood your ground, but you were also, this is sort of something I hadn't thought about, but I think it's very important. You were very even-tempered about the whole thing. I mean, it was everything was on a factual level, and there was no hysteria, amongst the leadership of the organization. It was, here are the facts. You were wrong here, 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 and here. And with your backing up, with your evidence showing that in fact your facts were the correct facts in that, in a particular case. And yeah, I noticed you were always ready for a conversion.
Right.
You never burned a bridge or cut somebody off or wrote somebody off or denounced somebody personally.
Right. We tended to take the position that, the company we thought were really bad guys, and the Swiss billionaires who owned them and who had never set foot in our town but basically wanted to take over our town, we would make, something of a boogeyman out of the corporate bad guys. But people in our community, were still our neighbors no matter which side they were on. So it was very important to be extremely respectful and willing to listen and then hope that they would eventually listen to us as well. And we are certainly very aware that citizens groups start out at an enormous disadvantage in that the press and to a certain extent the general public tends to assume that you are hysterical and don't know what you're talking about and to give a lot of deference to public officials and to people with engineering degrees and company lawyers and even paid PR people, and especially in smaller communities, tend to be treated as, well, they're officials, so they must be right, and citizens who are worried about their homes and their families, are just strident you know, irrational folks who will eventually be proved wrong. So we very consciously tried to both project, you know, a reasonable and thoughtful image, and we're extremely careful to document everything that we put out in the public domain, you know, with facts. And really, I don't know that we ever got caught in a slip-up. If we had, we would have immediately said, you know what, actually, you know, we'll give the company that one. You know, we made a mistake, you know, to demonstrate that we weren't, you know, purely partisan. But we had a pretty excellent track record of sticking to the facts. And, you know, I always said to people, you know, if you question any of what I'm telling you, come down to the office. I've got it all in our files. I'll show you where I got that from. You know, I'll give you the source material and let you decide for yourself.
And that's a very important theme. I'll make the facts available to you and let you decide for yourself.
Right.
That was, I think, that ran throughout the entire campaign. It wasn't a matter of, you know, be with us or if you're not with us, you're against us. If someone
right.
for that.
I think the other half of that equation that kind of is embedded in that idea is that, you know, part of our task was to really demolish the credibility of the adversary, and we loved to basically use the companies and in some cases public officials' own statements, you know, their own application materials, their own you know, internal records which we would obtain through freedom of information requests and what have you, to show that the company and the politicians who were backing them were misleading the public. And that was a very slow process, but we went back and back and back over the facts, showing how the official line changed over time, showing how their own statements were contradictory, showing how the company had been a bad actor in other communities, so that over time, you know, people just stopped believing that both the company and the people who were supporting them. And, you know, we didn't do it gratuitously. We just used the facts that were available to us and kept very careful track of all the materials so that whenever we had an opportunity to catch them in a lie, you know, we would get that information out in a big way.
And that,
I know sometimes people are hesitant to do that, but it's really essential.
And that process converted a lot of people, I think, locally, because it became apparent. I think if I remember correctly, there was a time when the company was hiring people to write basically fake letters to the newspaper, pretending to be citizens, pretending to, you know, be in support of the plant, pretending to be against people who were concerned about the plant. And when that came out that was a company ruse, I think a lot of people who learned of that lost faith in the company's integrity on the matter.
Yeah, I think when people start to feel like somebody's trying to fool them or taking them for a fool, they really can turn around very quickly. You know, someone who initially says, "Well, I trust the government or I trust the company to do the right thing," you know, who then later, you know, sees conclusive proof that the people that they were supporting have been operating in bad faith, they then can become some of the most intense opponents of the folks they formally opposed. And so that process, it was really like a, you know, Chinese water torture. It was just a drip, drip, drip of information about, you know, this company is not being straight with our community. And it was important to constantly refer to, like, our community versus their kind of narrow private interests and you know, to further reinforce, you know, well, what's their motivation for doing this? You know, it does take a lot of digging, and, you know, sometimes it's just a matter of archiving the material. I mean, we had just files and files full of newspaper articles and applications and, you know, documents, as I mentioned, obtained by Freedom of Information requests and the rest of it, and keeping track of that and having a lot of different people, you know, who were involved in gathering the information so that when somebody, you know, from the company or from, you know, the governor's office said something, you know, we'd realize, you know, that's not right. Just a couple of years ago, they were saying the exact opposite. And then you just put the two statements side by side and say, what's going on here? Somebody's got to be lying.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So if we were to sort of recap some of this,
mm-hmm.
when you started, the group was very small.
Mm-hmm.
The company had been working behind the scenes for months, building and you know its support among the local politicians, the local media, the state politicians, so that when this thing was announced, the near universal perception was this is terrible, but it's already over. We can't do anything about it.
Yeah.
And then your immediate task was, well, first, not to give in, and then second, to start gathering and finding people who didn't buy the party line. There were many people that didn't buy the party line but thought it was hopeless. So when you showed up and showed a willingness to do something about it and gave them an opportunity to talk about their own thoughts and feelings about it, and also gave them access to information that nobody else was providing them, now you've created a member of your, we'll call it an army, really, and you relentlessly built up the numbers of that army, kept the morale high, and we're going to talk a little bit about some other things you did, social things that I think were really, really important. They were important to me, I'll tell you.
I think a crucial element to that slow build was emboldening people, and you know that part of that was giving them tools and knowledge that they could act on, and part of it was kind of strength in numbers and being personally you know fearless on the issue. A lot of us you know had never really been involved with anything like this before. You know, we were just going on with our lives, doing our jobs, you know. Living our lives with our families, and suddenly this giant intrusion came in, and the natural, you know, reaction is, ugh, you know, I don't have time for this on top of everything else that's going on in my life. And then there was a lot of fear, too. You know, it's a big company, you know, the cement industry, you know, people can't tell you the number of times when people said, oh, you know, those people are all connected to the mafia or this or that. You know, there's a lot of reasons why people don't get involved, and I think the number one thing is they need to feel like there's others standing with them,
mm-hmm.
and that you know that there's a certain solidarity, and also making it fun. I mean, the number of people who you know initially didn't want to put a sign on their building or on their lawn, you know, out of fear, who were able to turn it around because you know we made it fun. We went out to artists or just anybody who was willing to pick up a paintbrush and got somebody to let us use their big barn and chopped up a bunch of wood and painted a ton of signs. And suddenly, you know, it was a more personal thing. We'd had a fun time socially. You know, the signs were creative, and people were more willing to put them up, especially when they saw other people doing it. And, you know, that's something that Peter Young, who was my main cohort in this, always emphasizes, you know, we've got to make this fun for people. It's got to be lively. Socially, we had a lot of big gatherings, small gatherings. We tried to keep it pretty down home and simple. You know, we would do things out at, there's a place in outside of Hudson called the Federation of Polish Sportsmen, if you can believe it, which is an old shooting club that had a big outdoor pavilion with barbecue pits. And, you know, we would do events there for $10, you know, potluck, plus what the sportsmen wanted to cook up. And, you know, the point wasn't even so much raising money. It was more raising morale. And the money would follow later. But people need to see that there's other people who feel the same way, that they're meeting people, that they're sharing some good times along the way. Otherwise, it's just too grim. You know, if it's a handful of people all, like, you know, staring at their computer till 3 in the morning thinking, God, this is awful, those people are eventually going to get worn down if there isn't, you know, new blood and social energy keeping them going.
And so you had things like parties and picnics. You had the annual picnic. at the Polish Sportsman's Club?
Yeah, we had a lot of success with, you know, silent auctions. We used to we had the picnic in the summer, and in the winter we would rent out at very low cost a high school gymnasium, and just have a big party in there. And local business people would donate everything from food to people would bring in crafts or services. You know, there was a woman who tuned pianos, who every year would donate, you know, two free piano tunings and put that in our auction, and you know, we would raise, you know, $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, you know, at an event where, you know, which cost $10, all you can eat, all you can drink, and people were having a ton of fun. And you know, I think one of the most revelatory things you said to me early on, this is in relation to direct mail, but I think it applies to other things, is, you know, you can keep mailing people until it stops paying for itself.
Yeah.
You know, and it took me a little while to get my mind around that. But, you know, if you do a 5,000-piece mailing or a 10,000-piece mailing and it costs X dollars and it brings in X plus $1, you just keep doing it, you know, so long as it's not costing you money. And to some extent, even if it costs you a little bit of money, you're getting a ton of information out to people at very low cost. You know, and that initially, you know, I hadn't really wrapped my head around that. And of course, you know, we tended to always do well. As long as our mailings were well presented and informative and graphically interesting, you know, we always, you know, reaped huge windfalls from these mailings, which was information we needed to get out anyway.
Yeah, that's what's so fascinating about so-called fundraising mailings.
Mm-hmm.
You are asking for funds, but you're also educating at the same time, and because you're asking for funds, you'll receive funds, and those donations, contributions, not only pay for the mailing but generate a profit. So, I mean, in business, you know, anytime you can advertise for free, or God, get paid to advertise, you would just do it endlessly.
We also tried to be, you know, creative. I mean, at one point we realized, well, you know, things were getting a little stagnant. We've been at it for about 3 years. And somebody came up with the idea of, well, these guys the company is based in Switzerland. We've been doing all this agitating locally. But there's a Swiss consulate down in New York City. Let's get a permit to do a protest outside the Swiss consulate in New York City. And the Swiss are, like, so, you know, conflict averse. You know, they're just like... you know, we got invited up to the consulate, and they assured us that the Swiss government had nothing to do with this project, and it was fun for our supporters. The Swiss press, there's actually a lot of Swiss press in the United States, you wouldn't think it, and they've got nothing to write about, so they were all over it. We got this massive publicity in Europe, which put a lot of pressure on the company board, and, you know, Saul Alinsky, who was the famous Chicago organizer who Obama famously or infamously was something of an acolyte of, always said, you know, the best tactic is one that your supporters enjoy. And that was one that people enjoyed. We rode down on the bus to the city. You know, we raised a little hell in front of the building. We scared these Swiss bureaucrats half to death, and we got a lot of media out of it. And, you know, we didn't do anybody harm. But it advanced our cause enormously, and people had some fun doing it, and it got us, you know, out of the rut that we were in year three.
Yeah, and this is a really great sort of multiple benefits. People had fun. You rattled the cage of the bureaucrats. You generated media attention. You brought fresh energy to something that, by its nature, is difficult to sustain.
We brought it into sort of the living room of these corporate guys who felt very insulated. You know, they felt they could really trash our area, you know, from a safe distance in Zurich or wherever they were. And you know, it's crucial to always, you know, to stay very focused on these issues, but to be constantly brainstorming, you know, to see if there's some new angle you missed. I mean, we did. Because, again, we were dealing with a multinational corporation. We did a lot of research about, you know, who were the shareholders, who were the board members, who were the stock analysts who report on, the cement industry and where people should put their money if they're investing in that industry. And we started to address materials towards them. It wasn't a main focus. But even just a little bit of that, we started having people send postcards to, the president of the company, the subsidiary office, which is up in Montreal, Canada, who would probably never had to deal directly with an organized citizens movement. And if it had gone on, next step was going to be to go to Montreal and then go to Zurich. So we just thought, how can we kind of take charge of the issue on our own end rather than waiting for the next horrible shoe to drop? How can we be driving the narrative and keeping our supporters energized and building new support rather than letting the company drive things? Because initially it was very much them. They were submitting an application. They were putting out a press release. They were lobbying the mayor. They were making donations to civic organizations to try to spread goodwill. And we had to get it where we were driving the narrative, not them.
Mm-hmm. And then ultimately, in a sense, you kept the issue alive long enough and attacked on enough different fronts that one of the fronts bore fruit.
Right. We were looking, as I've already said, at the local level, the county level, the state level, and the federal level for different handles, a way to win this issue. And we worked on all of those levels. We ultimately identified kind of a state-level process, which involved projects that fall in a coastal zone along a major river or ocean, which required a special permit, which is given on the state level and can be appealed to the federal level. And we focused heavily on that and identified the officials who were responsible for it and eventually got meetings with them and directed a huge amount of public comment, set some records there in terms of the number of letters they had received from citizens, and identified the pressure points. We had business people address themselves to this agency. We had it was very important for us to gather allies, which ranged from everything from the doctors of our local hospital to other major environmental organizations, with a national profile, not just a small regional one, and directing all those people at this pressure point where we finally got a decision that killed the project. And, as far as strategy goes, it can't be emphasized enough that to win any issue, whether it's an environmental issue or, really any political issue or planning issue, you have to really fully understand the process and who ultimately has the power to give you, to satisfy your needs or your demands, and to direct your supporters' attention relentlessly towards outcomes that can really tangibly advance your cause, as opposed to sort of just expressing general outrage or concern. I think that's where a lot of citizens groups sort of stumble is it's not that hard to whip up some interest and some concern and some outrage even, but really giving people things to do that will move the cause to successful completion is where the focus I think needs to be.
Mm-hmm. So if we were kind of break this down into departments. You need a research department so that you're finding out, continually finding out more and more and more about the issue, things that have been said about the issue by various parties, what's true, what's not true, who the players are, who's going to have the power to influence the outcome. So that's the research department. And then converting that research into action, and the action would be packaging information to send to the members so the members are better informed and better motivated, then converting that information into specific actions that you ask the members to undertake. It seems to me it always ends up going back, it always ends up on with your membership base. If you have a large, growing, excited, motivated, well-educated, connected membership base. They feel connected to the cause. They feel connected to each other. Then you have this wonderful resource that you can deploy often on short notice. You know, you decide you want to go down to New York and pick it in front of the Swiss consulate. You're there. You know, you identify a bureaucrat in Albany who needs some mail sent to him, and boom, the mail's coming. But that only comes if you've done the meticulous work of building and maintaining the group.
Yeah, and a cause can seem very hopeless and feel like, well, geez, if only I had enough people to get on a bus and go do this at the consulate, or if only I had more people who would come to a meeting and speak out, or I need 100 letters to this official, or 500 or 1,500 letters to this agency in order to get a good outcome. But until you've invested the time in building that army, you know, it really does feel like, you know, rolling a rock up the hill. But it's amazing what, you know, just a, you know, adding a member a day or making one incremental gain per day or per week, you know, that adds up so that you're, you know, when the comes time for the final, I don't want to necessarily say battle, it doesn't all have to be in terms of, you know, warfare imagery, but, you know, you want to have all those troops assembled before you get to that crucial point. And
that's kind of fun. Yeah, and that's a key part of this. There was a lot of fun along the way, and I'll be honest, there were times when I thought, you know, we may not prevail, but because there was an organization and there was a group, and we were always having something to do, and we were always getting the sense of there was forward progress, even however small, I thought, well, I'm just going to stick with this till the end. Win, lose, or draw. And that's important because, people won't stay with something. I think logically, people won't stay with something that seems, you know, just beyond hope. So it's important to give the sense that, you know, we are moving forward. We're not going to stop until the end.
Well, and we were really, you know, we were out to win outright. We really felt that, you know, after we learned all these things about this company and the nature of their project, you know, we felt we have to win, you know, 100%. But even so, we structured our campaign so that even if we didn't win, we would have, you know, at least diminished the blow. You know, we really tried to structure, in particular, our legal strategy so that if somehow they got it built, it at least would be less destructive to the community, and that we would be assured of getting some concessions. You know, we still, pardon me, our hope was to win outright, and we did. But we didn't, to call it an all-or-nothing strategy would be inaccurate, because we wanted to make sure that, you know, the worst-case scenario was better than what we started out with. If
gotcha.
That makes sense.
Absolutely. You had a plan B and a plan C.
Yeah, and we had a real menu of demands. You know, we started out by not saying, you know, this plant must be stopped. We started out by saying, you know, why aren't they using this technology? Why does it have to be quite so big? Why are they using coal instead of natural gas? Why does the, you know, how about shrinking the mine? How about putting these types of monitors on the plant and having the following, you know, automatic penalties or remedial actions if something goes wrong with the plant, as so often does in the cement industry. You know, and we were kind of whittling away at the project, both because we realized if we made it small enough, the company would lose interest, and secondly, that if we lost, at least it would be a smaller, lower impact facility. It also was another way that we, you know, the strategy we used to project like a more reasonable face to the world, to say, look, there's a way to build plants like this, but the location needs to be changed, the technology needs to be changed, the monitoring needs to be changed, the regulatory scheme controlling the plant needs to be changed. And in the back of our minds, we knew the company was never going to agree to these things, but we could get regulators on our side and the public on our side by saying, hey, these guys are bringing forward constructive suggestions, and this company just keeps saying, no, 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 we won't give on anything. And that ended up making us the reasonable ones and meant that even if they got a plant built, it would be so much smaller, it would be less of a disaster for the community.
Well, what about
although I, in my heart, didn't trust this company to build. I wouldn't have trusted them to build a gas station, let alone a massive coal-fired plant.
Everybody wants to do their homework on this company. You'll see they definitely don't have a good record. You know, thinking back on one of the hot buttons for me late in the day on this was Friends of Hudson was raising the issue of use medical waste and tires as fuel, and one of the campaigns was that we want St. Lawrence Cement to promise that they're not going to use this stuff, and of course the St. Lawrence refused.
Right.
And I mean, wow, that spoke volumes about what their intentions were for the plant, for the community. They just clearly didn't really care. Because that was just a horrifying image of medical waste, being burned in the city limits in large quantities.
And this is a great example of how identifying a wedge issue can be so powerful in these very difficult situations. That even we eventually got some money together to do some polling to see how we were doing and what people were thinking. And one of the things we found out was that even among people who supported the project, the basic cement plant project, that even supporters of the company, 80% of them did not want them to burn tires, medical waste, to basically use the plant as an incinerator as well as a cement plant.
Mm-hmm.
And we knew that this was really essential to the cement industry's bottom line in the 21st century, that this is, what they like to do, and it's a hugely profitable aspect of the industry. So we took that information and started to box the company in on the waste issue. And this allowed us to convert a lot of the, in particular, some of the public officials that were initially in favor of the project. It gave them it both separated them from the company, and it gave them a way of speaking to their constituents of saying, look, I still support the plant. I'm just asking for them to say we'll never burn, hazardous waste in the plant. And when the company then became totally, resistant to making that concession, it opened their eyes and got us to turn around some of these votes on our local common council, which was, asked by the company basically for a vote of support. It's very that highlights another useful lesson that we learned kind of the hard way, but eventually we learned it, was that it's really important to, if somebody has staked out a position on the opposite side of your issue, you got to figure out a way for them to gracefully switch positions, to give them an out. Besides just I changed my mind, they need to feel like I can present a reasonable narrative of how I went from point A to point Z. And so we were very aware of that. Part of it is just maintaining cordial relationships with people who aren't on your side yet. But the other was like really looking for creative ways to say, here's how you can justify your change of heart.
Here's some new facts, or here's something that something that the company has exposed about itself. For instance, when it would promise not to burn medical waste, that changed the story, which allowed reasonable people to change their minds.
Right, and that left the company as the bad guy on the outside, and the public official, looking like a reasonable guy who was consistent all along. He was just basing his position on what facts were available to him, and when those changed, he changed. It's very important for politicians to look like they're well informed and responsive. Very often they aren't, but when you give them the opportunity to, when you basically hand them, the whole narrative they need to make that shift, it becomes a lot easier.
Well, great. I think we've covered a lot of ground and given people a lot to think about. But if I were to summarize it, is it's not a matter of just research and just writing letters and position papers. It's a matter of gathering people who feel the same way, and then educating, and then creating a mechanism for educating the community about what the facts of the matter are. And as you build that critical mass of people, suddenly what seems impossible becomes possible, and then becomes probable even. So I hope people who are interested in this topic will listen to this call maybe more than once and take notes and think about the structure of how this unfolded. I want to just remind everybody this started out as an utterly hopeless situation. Hudson is a town that's a city that's sort of struggling in certain ways financially. And, you know, this huge company with all the resources in the world had sewn up all the local politicians and state-level politicians and bureaucrats, all the media. The media started out quite hostile. Some, I would say, even some public officials started out quite hostile. Many, many people in the city were afraid to express their opinion initially. Even those who were concerned about the plant, they not only thought it was a lost cause, but they were afraid of personal attack or just, you know, social unpleasantness that they'd experience. And by creating this group through education and the internet and direct mail and education and live events and giving people specific tasks to do and having a storefront, all of a sudden Friends of Hudson became a major force in the community that was respected, and people felt comfortable standing by. And you mentioned the term snowball, it does snowball after a while, and all of a sudden this group that was on the outs and had no possibility of success is suddenly a force to be reckoned with. And in this case, because the facts were on your side, the facts were finally listened to, because you made enough noise for long enough in a tactically intelligent way that justice prevailed in the case.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the number one thing I always say to people is there's no such thing as a done deal. There's always a way to win. You know, it sometimes takes a phenomenal amount of persistence. It can take years, but you definitely can do it. And you know, the more you get out there among the public and make your case, it's amazing that the people and the resources that will come forward to support you. You just got to get out there.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Sam Pratt.
Thank you.
Look forward to talking with you more about this. And I'll be right back.
Okay.